You're listening to the BBC. I'm Paul Henley. This is Europe Today, and coming up in the next half hour of the programme, the latest on the shooting of a journalist in Athens and how one commentator fears that it marks the return to the political violence of the 1980s there. Serbia and Croatia strive to put their Balkan war animosities behind them, and soldiers who died in Fromelles in France in the First World War are finally laid to rest. Those are the stories coming up in the next half hour of Europe Today after the world news.
BBC News with David Legg. Pakistan's Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi has said the convergence of interests between his country and the United States is greater than ever before. Earlier, the American Secretary of State Hillary Clinton announced new aid projects for Pakistan in areas including health, energy and employment. The Washington Post newspaper says the intelligence and surveillance system created in the US after the attacks of September the 11th is so big that it's impossible to determine its effectiveness. The paper says almost 1,300 government organizations and about 2,000 private ones are involved, resulting in an unwieldy system with high levels of waste. The oil company BP has been given a further 24 hours to test the cap over a stricken well in the Gulf of Mexico. Seepage has been detected from the ocean floor since the device was lowered last week. There are fears the cap may be pushing oil into surrounding rocks, which could cause leaks in the longer term. Police in Greece say a far-left extremist group, the Sect of Revolutionaries, is likely to have been behind the killing of a Greek investigative journalist, Socrates Giolias, who's been shot dead outside his house in Athens. Two packed commuter trains have crashed in the Indian state of West Bengal, killing at least 60 people and leaving others trapped in the wreckage. A court in Istanbul has indicted 196 people for planning to overthrow the Turkish government, which is run by a party with its roots in political Islam. The suspects include serving and former military officers, some of them generals and admirals. The last of 250 British and Australian soldiers killed at the Battle of Fromelles in France during the First World War has been buried with full military honours. The final body was recovered along with others from mass graves. The burial marks the end of 2 years of painstaking exhumations. BBC News.
BBC World Service, this is Europe Today. There's been condemnation in Greece from across the political spectrum of the murder of an investigative journalist who was gunned down in Athens before dawn today. Socrates Giolias, who was 37, was shot by what are reported to be three gunmen. Police forensic reports in the past couple of hours have linked the bullets involved to weapons belonging to a left-wing revolutionary group. I've been talking to Nikos Zacharidis, who's a radio host of the programme on Tamer Radio, the station of which the victim was director.
Hey everyone, get ready for Terra Informa, your environmental news programme. I'm Marcus Peterson, and I'll be your host for the next half hour. First up, we have Brett Taggart with a review of Rising Tide North America's latest publication, Hoodwinked in the Hothouse. And he finds out which purported solutions to climate change are pure gold and which are pure bunk. Then Steve Anderson will be talking to bicycle traffic reporter Carly Coleman on cycling while away from home. Finally, we fire up the flux capacitor and take a trip in the Wayback Time Machine to Terra Informa's archives. And we find one of our favorite pieces from last year. But before all that, we have Tasneem Karbani up first with the news.
This is Terra Informa's news segment, where we bring you the week's top environmental stories. The Alberta oil sands is the target of a new marketing campaign aimed at discouraging Americans from considering the province for travel plans and tourism. Corporate Ethics International is the group behind the campaign, and is part of a coalition of 100 environmental groups and NGOs from America, Europe, and Canada. They are critical of the environmental damage caused by the oil sands and have launched billboards in Portland, Denver, Seattle, and Minneapolis, places that typically have many U.S. visitors to Alberta. The campaign is not relegated to the billboards, however. Advertisements will pop up on the internet whenever anyone does a Google search for Alberta destinations. A similar campaign is being launched in the United Kingdom in 2 weeks. Travel Alberta, which promotes tourism, though disappointed, said it was not overly worried by the campaign. The campaign itself has not been without controversy, however. The group has been criticized for some of the facts used in its videos. On its Rethink Alberta website, a video stated that the oil sands development in Alberta is destroying an area twice the size of England. Spokesman for Corporate Ethics, Kenny Bruno, said the video meant to say the size of England, approximately 130,000 square kilometers. Bruno said, quote, "Yes, there was one editing error. I hope that's not the entire focus. Our goal here is to reform and clean up that industry and its reckless expansion. We've got a lot bigger issues than one editing error," end quote. In British Columbia, the Minister of Energy, Mines and Petroleum Resources, Bill Bennett, was forced to apologize for an email he sent to his constituents where he called environmentalists who want to turn the Flathead Valley into a national park, quote, eco-fascists. The email said, quote, "These protectors of the earth will use whatever legal, political, dishonest means they can muster. And we either stand strong together against the loss of the Flathead Valley to the eco-fascists, or we will lose the Flathead," end quote. Bennett apologized for the message, noting that it was sent by a new employee of his, and he had not authorized it to be sent out. Bennett maintains that he remains opposed to the park. Quote, "For those folks who want a park, they're going to see all kinds of sinister things in this. We just disagree with them fundamentally. I believe the bulk of my constituents are opposed to locking up the Flathead Valley," end quote. According to a recent report from Democracy Now!, scientists are warning that glaciers in the Himalayan region in Asia are receding faster than anywhere else in the world and has the potential of affecting over 1 billion people. The Himalayan glaciers are the key source of water to 10 major Asian river systems, including ones in Afghanistan, Bangladesh, Bhutan, China, India, Burma, Nepal, and Pakistan. By the end of the century, it is predicted 75% of the Himalayan glaciers could be gone. In an interview with Democracy Now!, Indian scientist Syed Iqbal Husnain, who is the chair of the Glacier and Climate Change Commission in the Sikkim government in India, explained that the South Asian countries, including China, have to cut down on the black carbon emissions to help stop the problem. Husnain has called for the global community to come together at the next climate change summit and come up with certain cuts globally and regionally. Photos of the Himalayan region were recently shot and compared to ones taken in 1921 by British climber George Mallory. The Asia Society, who arranged for the new photos to be taken in the region, said the photographs illustrate the severity of the loss of ice mass among the glaciers surrounding Mount Everest. The rate of the loss of a vital source could have a disastrous effect on the hundreds of millions of people who depend on the seasonal flows for their livelihoods. And finally, an update on the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. 87 days after the disastrous oil spill and numerous attempts to stop it, British Petroleum finally reported the leak as being under control on July 16th. Thus far, the oil spill has cost BP over $3.5 billion U.S. Despite the apparent control on the leak, at the time there were still concerns among engineers about the low pressure readings. Engineers are trying to determine whether that can mean the leak is being held or could spring up again. Plugged or not, there is still a big cleanup ahead for the millions of gallons of oil that have leaked into the Gulf, as well as compensation for those whose livelihoods have been affected by the oil spill. Meanwhile, the leak has put pressure on the United Kingdom to ban North Sea drilling. The European Energy Commissioner, Gunther Oettinger, wants to impose a moratorium on new wells from being developed. Oettinger commented in the European Parliament that, quote, "any responsible government would at present practically freeze new permits for drilling with extreme parameters and conditions," end quote. That's the wrap-up of this week's news. For more information, sources, and photos of the receding Himalayan glaciers, you can visit our website at terrainforma.ca. Back to you, Marcus.
Thanks, Tasneem. Only a few years ago, many companies were saying climate change wasn't a problem. Now, as its impacts become apparent, many of the same corporations are scrambling to present solutions and quick fixes to avoid new environmental regulations. This week, Brent Taggart reviews Rising Tide's newly updated pamphlet, Hoodwinked in the Hothouse, an environmental inquisition rooting out the climate change solutions that are false, foolhardy, and doomed to failure.
Climate change presents an enormous challenge. We have to overhaul our economy, energy, agriculture, transport, consumption, and entire social system to have a chance of avoiding its worst impacts. The science of climate change is frightening. The potential for a 21st century wracked by dangerous global climate change is already leading some to give up on hope for the future. The barriers to rapid, widespread, and sustainable change are not technical. The technical means to cut greenhouse gas emissions to practically zero already exist. Rather, the core obstacles are political and cultural. Only a powerful grassroots movement for social change can overcome these obstacles. Support for a range of false solutions, dressed up as fail-safe answers, pose a big danger. Typically, the false solutions offer the promise of a techno-fix, or the wisdom of the market, to solve what is the result of an anti-ecological economic and social system. Some of these, such as carbon offsets and carbon cap-and-trade schemes, have gained a certain credibility. This is not only due to their powerful backers, but because they exploit people's fear of change and the unknown. The second edition of the wildly popular booklet Hoodwinked in the Hothouse, newly released by Rising Tide North America, is a useful primer on many of the bogus answers to runaway climate change offered up by business and governments. With the incredibly rapid pace of the climate policy debate, the second edition provides key updates to crucial topics like REDD, a market method of preserving forests in a similar fashion to trading carbon credits between nations, which were just emerging at the time of initial publication. Carbon capture and storage, clean coal in industry PR speak, heads the list. Clean coal is based on the lie that carbon dioxide from coal-fired power stations can be safely captured and stored underground. Even though its biggest supporters admit it can't be rolled out for 2 decades at the least, it's still very handy for the coal corporations. It legitimizes the continued dominance and expansion of the coal industry under the notion that coal can someday be clean. Liquefied natural gas is often hailed as a clean alternative to coal. It is slightly less polluting than other fossil fuels, but that doesn't mean it's climate-friendly. The growth of the biofuels industry is causing havoc in the poorest regions of the world. Promoted as a clean alternative to oil, biofuels convert food for people into fuel for cars. The biofuels industry played a big part in the sharp rise in food prices in 2008, which threw a further 100 million people into the ranks of the world's 1 billion malnourished. Biofuels are also hardly carbon neutral, as their backers claim. Because it results in deforestation, unsustainable water use, and dependence on chemical fertilizers, the industry rivals the burning of fossil fuels as a contributor to climate change. The new second edition expands to more technologies that are being branded as green, despite the grave dangers associated with them, such as waste incineration, biochar, and genetically engineered carbon-sucking trees. They've also included much more information on real solutions and positive steps that communities can take to stop the climate crisis. The nuclear power industry is also working hard to cast off its radioactive image and rejuvenate itself as a clean, green, CO2-free techno-fix for global warming. But building nuclear plants and the mining, processing, and transportation of uranium is highly energy-intensive and wastes huge amounts of water. There is no safe way to store radioactive waste, and the potential for uranium to be converted into nuclear weapons remains. Climate activists globally have denounced carbon trading schemes as another false solution, which delay the transition to a zero carbon emission society. A big problem is that carbon trading schemes seek to privatize the atmosphere and make pollution a tradable commodity. Traders find them hugely profitable, but none of the schemes give an incentive for a rapid shift away from fossil fuels. Carbon offsetting encourages us to think that we can buy our way out of the change we need to make to the way we live, but the reality is that the vast majority of offset projects are either scientifically dubious or minor tweaks that distract us from the large changes we need to make in our backyard. A dizzying array of geoengineering proposals have also emerged, which rely on industrial-scale manipulation of sensitive ecosystems. Some of the wackiest include using battleship guns to fire tons of sulfates into the sky. Sulfates have a cooling effect. They also cause acid rain. Erecting giant sunshades in space at a price tag of about $16 trillion. Fertilizing the oceans to make them better carbon sinks. And coating deserts with shiny white plastic to reflect sunlight back into space. However, there is one technology that backers of business-as-usual responses to climate change are anxious to avoid. Hoodwinked in the hothouse includes British journalist George Monbiot's summary of how it works. From the goodness of my heart, I offer it to you for free. No patents, no small print, no hidden clauses. Already this technology, a radical new kind of carbon capture and storage, is causing a stir among scientists. It is cheap, it is efficient, and it can be deployed right away. It's called leaving fossil fuels in the ground. A human-centered response to the crisis would place at its heart the repayment of ecological debt owed to the global south by the rich nations. Alberta has an obligation to cut domestic emissions first, and to do everything possible to help the third world avoid ruin. A zero-emissions economy would look very different to today's profit-driven capitalism. Replacing growth as the main objective of the economy is a fundamental change that must be made to address climate change, the booklet says. The battle to halt climate change will be a process of fundamental social change. The stranglehold that corporate interests and centuries-old colonialism has over political decision-making must be broken by citizens, and Hoodwinked provides vital, scientifically sourced information toward that goal.
Thanks, Brett. If you're interested in reading more about greenwashing yourself, you can check out terrainforma.ca for links to Rising Tide's brochure, and you can download it in its entirety in either English or Spanish for free. You're listening to Terra Informa, and I'm your host, Marcus Peterson. If you miss an episode of Terra Informa, you can download or stream them all for free at our website. Also, if you want more frequent updates on environmental news, subscribe to our Facebook feed by searching for Terra Informa and clicking like. We post updates on breaking stories all throughout the week. Terra Informa's bicycle traffic reporter, Carly Coleman, is away on vacation at the moment. But even when she's on holidays, she's never far from a bicycle. Today, Steve talks to her about cycling while away from home and some of the facilities that are available in central Canada.
Carly Coleman is our regular cycling reporter here on Terra Informa. She's been away in Ontario and Quebec on vacation for the last few weeks, so we haven't heard much from her lately. But I understand that she's brought along her Brompton folding bicycle and has been taking in all the cycling that Central Canada has to offer. So I thought we'd give her a call and see what sort of interesting stuff she's come across in her travels. So Carly, I understand you're in Ottawa right now?
I am. It's been super fun, Steve. I've been traveling about quite a bit.
How long have you been gone for?
Well, on the 20th of July, it'll be a complete month.
Wow. So I imagine you've seen all sorts of interesting cycling stuff. What kind of things have you come across?
Mayhem. I've come across mayhem. I'm not completely sure how people get around on bicycles in Canada, but they're managing it, and we have counted 750-some cyclists from starting in Edmonton, going to Halifax, and returning to Ottawa today. And that doesn't include any of the major cities. We sort of stop as soon as we get to the major city, and because there are just so many in Montreal and Toronto and Quebec, just a plethora of cyclists. So I've given up counting them, but I have watched how they maneuver around, and holy bloody hell, I'm not sure about that.
So what sort of not-so-ideal cycling maneuvers have you seen?
Let's start in Montreal. We cycled around in Montreal yesterday for the entire day, and really it's quite lovely to do so. The challenging part is on Sherbrooke, for instance. It's Sherbrooke? Anyway, some major street in Quebec City, or Montreal rather, has a bicycle lane that is on the south side of the road, and it's a two-way bicycle lane, and so as a car driver, you have to be completely aware of whether there's cyclists turning or pedestrians crossing, and whether they're coming from north or south on that route, so that you have to stop for both of them. And it's just an incredible conglomeration of cyclists at the intersection that the car driver waits for it to pass, and then it's just the whole mishmash of things, and then people riding the wrong way down one-way streets, and oh heavens, Steve, it was boggling. It was boggling. That's all I have to say. As a can bike instructor, I was boggled.
Okay, so that's some of the not so good. Have you seen some more positive things in your travels?
Oh, yes. In terms of positivity, the sheer number of cyclists that are out in the world is a joy to behold. There's just hordes of people out cycling, which is brilliant.
Now, you mentioned when you were talking to me earlier that one of the things you came across was La Route Verte in Quebec. Can you talk about that a bit?
It is a completely segregated cycling route, and there are a number of them all through Quebec. And so they're very similar to the Trans-Canada Trail, except they go everywhere in Quebec. And it's so lovely because, for the most part, they're completely separate from cars. But where they are not separate from cars, they're very well delineated or marked. And so you can travel about easily and freely. And so, as an example, between Quebec City and Montreal, Andy, my beloved, and I counted 100 cyclists over that hour drive. And that's a pile of cyclists on the, I believe it was the Route Verte 5 or number 5. So that's the green route is what it translates into. And when you go to bike stores in Quebec, you can pick up either free or at a small charge the route, all the routes. And associated with them are a number of hotels and bed and breakfasts and inns all along there that offer accommodation to cyclists or in some manner facilitate your ride. So they could offer, they could pick up your bikes or deliver your bikes to some particular area if you're touring, or they could do a special lunch or what have you. And if you go to the route, if you Google the route La Route Verte, LaRouteVerte, you will get to the website, and it's just a lump of information in both English and French.
Wow, that sounds pretty incredible. I know as a cyclist, one of the things that I hear a lot of complaints about, at least out here in Alberta, is that while cycling may be good within your city, trying to get to any other municipality nearby can be murder on the highways.
Well, and that's true. It can be murder. And you know what else is happening that's quite disastrous is there are a number of little towns on the outside of Calgary that are voting to have cycling banned on their roadways, which means effectively you would be stuck either inside Calgary or outside Calgary, outside of those districts, but you wouldn't be able to get through them because you wouldn't be able to cycle legally in that area. So it's a huge problem because how would you be a touring cyclist, which really, frankly, when you think about it, the disposable income of a touring cyclist is pretty good. They're between their 30s and 60s. They have lots of income that they're willing to spend on touring in your area, and they have lovely bikes, and they want to upkeep them and eat and sleep and do all manners of, touristy stuff in your area. And if you ban them from your area, then you're shooting yourself in the foot, frankly.
It's interesting to see what a difference there is between the way Albertans and Quebecers are treating their cyclists, say.
Yeah, it's pretty sad.
And it must be nice, too, to have all those facilities, like bed and breakfast, that are willing to come and pick you up. And it's nice to see those sorts of facilities available for cyclists.
It's been brilliant, Steve. And when we bought some Bromptons to take with us, so we have them in the back of our car, and we zoom around by car, and then we park, pick the Bromptons out, unfold them, zoom around all day yesterday. It was, 30-some degrees, and brilliantly hot, fabulously beautiful to cycle around in Montreal. There's fabulously marked trails and maps. And actually, you know, we stopped at this map that was posted at the side of the road, and suddenly we thought there were just some random people hanging out in the shade, but they were actually tourists or tour guide people who gave us information about where to go in Montreal for food and how to get back to where we were staying and where we were at the moment and did we know about these particular things. So kind of ambassadors for cycling in that area. It was really fun to see.
Oh, that's awesome. Thanks for filling us in on all your travels, Carly.
Hey, no worries. It's been a total pleasure, and we'll talk to you again.
That was Carly Coleman speaking to us from Ottawa. Back to you, Marcus.
Thanks, Steve. Terra Informa is always looking for new volunteers. If you feel like joining the team or giving us a suggestion for a news story, drop us a line at terra@cjsr.com or phone us at the Terra Informa listener line at 780-492-2577 extension 236. That's 780-492-2577 extension 236. You can also check out terrainforma.ca for more information about the stories you've heard today, an archive of past shows, and blog postings on all sorts of environmental topics. Here's a sample of one of our personal favorites from the archives, and we hope it's yours too.
I'm here with Christine Robichaud today, who is a master's student at the University of Alberta. Hi, Christine.
Hello, Rebecca.
So what's the primary objective of your research?
The primary objective of my research is to identify the relative importance of caribou in bear diets in a system called the Little Smoky area, which is a woodland caribou herd in west central Alberta.
Oh, okay. What is the status of the caribou there?
The Little Smoky, like I said, is a woodland caribou, and the population itself is at immediate risk of extirpation. There's only an estimated 80 individuals left in this herd, but the subspecies itself, the woodland caribou across Canada, is threatened, according to CoSeaWeek.
Oh, wow. So, and are bears a problem in terms of predation on caribou? Why are bears of importance?
Well, the Little Smoky herd, or the area itself, is being managed for caribou conservation. And as such, the government, through Alberta Fish and Wildlife Division, has implemented a wolf control program, which means that they've been using aerial gunning to remove predators. And this has been ongoing for the fourth winter now. We thought that that could have some potential very large impacts on the system. So when you remove a large predator like wolves, there's a chance that other predators could come in and sort of compensate for the reduction in wolf predation on the caribou.
Oh, so taking out the wolves would not really fix the problem.
Exactly. It's kind of a band-aid. I mean, the wolf problem is a result of habitat modifications that have been going on due to several anthropogenic or human influences. Other predators could easily come in, like I mentioned, bears. That's been documented in areas from Alaska down to the Yellowstone ecosystem, where black bears and especially grizzly bears can be very important predators of calves.
Okay, so and what are your results showing? Are bears important predators of caribou calves?
Well, I was testing sort of a newer method that uses stable isotopes. And so what we can do is look at the composition of carbon and nitrogen in bear hair and then compare what the bear hair is made of to the different kinds of food that bears could be eating.
Oh, wow.
So by making a relationship between what the hair is made of and the different foods are made of, we can determine the relative amounts of the different foods that the bear would have eaten. So this was, like I said, testing this method, and it turned out that it didn't really work. So I guess that was too bad for me. But I did, however, find some very interesting results.
Okay, so what did you find?
Well, I found that bears in the area have a really wide range in the amount of terrestrial meat or terrestrial protein, which I'm calling it, in their diet. So I've seen some individuals that have, you know, about 2% terrestrial protein in their diets to up to 58%. So that's a really wide range.
Wow.
Especially for a species like bears, which we